flirting with good ideas. Vienna, 1926, and Slava Duldig was looking forward to a pleasant Sunday walk in the gardens of the Kunsthistorisches Museum, a favourite haunt. Except that the prospect on this May morning, with its ominous-looking clouds, was not so inviting. And so, to prepare for the likely showers, she took a heavy umbrella with her. She captured her frustration in her notebook. "Why on earth must I carry this utterly clumsy thing? They should invent a small, foldable umbrella that could be easily put in a handbag." A great idea. But they hadn't done it yet. And so Slava decided to remedy the situation. She was a sculptress, a successful artist, used to working with ideas and giving them form. She played around with the notion, sketched some designs, and realized that to fit in her bag, the umbrella would not only have to be small, it would need a folding mechanism. Now, where else had she seen something like that? A flash of insight, and she was off, peering excitedly into shop windows and talking to owners of businesses specialising in window blinds. And she'd need some kind of frame, lightweight, to give shape, so another shopping expedition to stores specialising in lampshades. Gradually, just like one of her sculptures, the prototypes took physical form, and her experiments continued. Having tested them out, she finally decided to patent her idea, by now called the Flirt, and lodged it in the Austrian Patent Office on September the 19th, 1929. The world's first folding umbrella was born. These days, around 500 million of its descendants are sold every year. Sometimes it's not just about starting from scratch, but about adapting something already there. In 1940, Joe Stevenson and many others like him was carrying a lot of responsibility on his 21-year-old shoulders. One of a small number of fighter pilots, he was flying every day, trying to defend the British skies over Kent and Sussex from waves of attack. His plane was the Supermarine Spitfire, the sleek, aerodynamically fast offspring of Reginald Mitchell's earlier work designing high-performance seaplanes to win the Schneider Trophy. Mitchell's efforts had helped shape a beautiful flying machine. Except, as Joe nearly discovered to his cost, it had a couple of flaws which Mitchell hadn't fully covered in his design. Like being able to see behind you without having to turn your head. Not a problem if you're joyriding the skies, but pretty serious if you're in a dogfight and need to know fast when someone is on your tail. Joe has a lot in common with Slava, even if the worlds of umbrellas and fighter pilots seem far apart. First of all, he's got a high incentive to innovate. He wants a solution to his problem. And he's not afraid to experiment, to improvise, try something out to see if it works. He thinks about his beloved MG sports car and the way his rearview mirror works, and decides to try and fit something similar inside his cockpit. It takes a few goes, some fiddling attempts to get it in the right place and to stay there, and he enlists the help of one of the aircraft fitters to develop an improvised bracket. It's not long after that the other pilots in his squadron have fitted their own. And soon after that, the Air Ministry issues a new specification requiring mirrors as a standard in new planes and arranging for modifications to existing ones. These aren't isolated cases. They're the stuff of everyday innovation. We're all of us improvisers, improving and modifying things, tweaking and adapting to suit our needs. And sometimes we get frustrated enough to come up with a whole new solution. Consider Reed Hastings, angry at being charged yet again late fees for his video rental from Blockbuster, says to himself, why not make it easier and simpler? And Netflix was born. Or Marion Donovan, hands red raw from washing out nappies, saying to herself, oh, why can't we make these things disposable? And so she did. Or Owen McLaren, seeing his daughter fumbling to try and assemble her pushchair whilst holding two babies, handbag, assorted toys and other child paraphernalia, saying to himself, "Oh, why can't I make something foldable, like the retractable undercarriage I designed for the Spitfire?" These pain points gave birth to Netflix, disposable nappies and foldable baby buggies, and there are thousands of other examples like them. They offer some important innovation lessons, in particular reminding us of one of the open innovation mantras which we hear often. As Bill Joy of Sun Microsystems famously said, "Even the largest organization has to recognize that not all the smart guys work for you. Go and look outside. Open up your search. Research on user innovation has taught us that there are plenty of smart men and women out there who have ideas worth looking at. Frustration leads to innovation, and so crowdsourcing, seeking out these ideas from a wide population, has much more to offer than just being a fashionable add-on to the marketing department. Tapping into user innovation offers some key advantages. Diversity and variety. No organization can afford to look at every possible product or service concept. But users not only explore, they target precisely the pain points, the frustrations, find the ones that others also worry about, and you may have uncovered a new market, not just a product idea. Patient experimentation. As we saw in the examples, and in countless others, users have the incentive to innovate and aren't afraid to try things out. And they follow that motto, if at first you don't succeed, try, try, try again. Famously, James Dyson went through over 5,000 prototypes before solving his problem with vacuum cleaning. Thomas Edison looked at 10,000 different materials before he found the right one for the filaments in his light bulb. Community building. Joe Stevenson wasn't the only pilot with a problem. Across the country, similar experiments and modifications were being made, and those ideas shared. Linus Torvalds wasn't the only programmer annoyed by the limitations of operating systems and interested in what a new version of Unix might offer. Pretty soon, he gathered a community around him of similarly minded experimentalists sharing code and ideas. The Linux community is typical of communities of practice. People with shared interests in improving, improvising, tinkering, all motivated by being part of the group as much as by the benefits they share. And these days we're just beginning to realize how much knowledge is held and shared by users, so it makes sense to try and tap into it. Accelerated diffusion. One of the problems in innovation is the better mousetrap that no one wants. People are conservative when it comes to new things, and one of the main reasons why they don't adopt is when something new doesn't fit with their world. Compatibility is critical, and what better way to ensure that something will fit than to use a design which originated from a bunch of users themselves? People trust new ideas which come from others like them, a concept Everett Rogers, who spent a lifetime studying innovation adoption, called homophily. People like us understand our world and design things which fit into it. So there's a rich opportunity for smart organizations to watch and learn from these ideas. The pickup truck wasn't an invention from the drawing boards of designers working for Ford or General Motors down in Detroit. It was developed and redeveloped by farmers, seeing each other's experiments towards adapting cars for work on the farm. And this isn't just a story of products and services. The same pattern works for processes as well. Who better to identify improvements and tweaks to make something work better than someone who's close to it, works with it every day? Not for nothing is one of the major planks in the road to world-class productivity, which the Toyota Way has laid down, a thing called Genchi Genbutsu. It basically means go to the real place where the knowledge can be found. Go to the source. Get close to where something is actually being done and observe. Who better to do this than the operators themselves? User innovation at work once again. So there's plenty of reasons for looking at user innovation. But some key questions remain around how we find and mobilize it. For example, crowdsourcing is powerful, but only if it's a serious attempt to widen the funnel at the front end of innovation and to listen to and explore novel ideas. Bolted on simply as a cosmetic addition to marketing is unlikely to pick up good ideas. Build communities and work with them. But then we need to feed them with ideas, with resources and challenges. And remember, these groups are pretty good at policing themselves, so free riding, just using the ideas without giving anything back, is soon damped out. The key principle in these groups is being prepared to give to get. We need to create space for interaction and ideas, find ways to enable prototyping. Increasingly, organizations are setting up or joining with makerspaces, fab labs, and other spaces in a physical world and their online equivalent as a way of creating meeting points around which innovation can happen. And recognize that it's a partnership. Co-creation is the key. Research repeatedly shows the power of user innovation, but it also has limitations. In particular, what motivates user innovators is solving their own problem. If it happens to help you as well, well, that's a nice bonus, but it's not essential. User innovators often aren't interested in moving to scale, and they certainly aren't experienced in doing so. So there's a real opportunity for complementarity. Users bringing ideas and community and insights for momentum, and then other organizations bringing resources and experience to enable moving those ideas to scale. So next time you're out walking, and the skies darken, the first drops of rain start to fall, and you take out your folding umbrella, spare a thought for Sava Duldig and the many others like her, user innovators who've given us some useful insights for how we might approach the innovation challenge in the future.